That's Debatable is sponsored by MB&G. MB&G are specialists in the esoteric world of vehicle and furniture warranty insurance, delivering quite marvellous customer service, prompt claims payment, and a highly developed understanding of how to deliver these products in a way that is both compliant with the regulations and attractive to customers. Hello and welcome to That's Debatable, the weekly news podcast of the Free Speech Union. Ben, welcome back. Welcome back to our listeners. You've had a heck of a week and a heck of a weekend, I think, haven't you, Ben?
I've not had a weekend.
But no Mother's Day for you.
No, I've not assigned in the right direction for that. But we have had an extremely busy week and weekend at Free Speech Union Towers. Before we go on to the main thing that I want to talk about today, I just want to quickly note and say thank you to all those who donated to the crowdfunder for Lindsay Smith in her legal battle. This is the Newcastle fan who was being spied upon, basically, by the Premier League, who compiled this
Stadium Stasi.
Stadium Stasi, about where she walked her dog, all this sort of stuff. Thanks very much to everyone who's donated to the crowdfund of that. So that's £10,000 brought in. Was it up for 4 or 5 days? I mean, not very long. So our members and donors, as always, just phenomenally generous. And it means that we can continue her battle. So it's great. And you know what's really nice is when I'm speaking to members who are in a situation where they're probably going to need legal advice, it's really great being able to say, look, we have this great track record of crowdfunding and we have really generous members, people putting in donations of 5, 10, 15, 20, 50 pounds and so on. And that means that people who otherwise wouldn't have legal help get it. So thank you.
It's always interesting to work out what really resonates with our members, isn't it, Ben? And we discuss this quite a lot internally. What kind of story in the free speech world actually gets our fundraisers moving quickly and gets our membership going up? And indignation, I think, is the theme or the emotion that more than anything gets people responding like this in that amazing way. And the idea of a Stadium Stasi, the idea that, you know, football, such an important part of our culture, has this going on in it. You know, sometimes I expect our listeners and our members are dealing with all the free speech woes during the week at work, and then to discover that on their Saturday afternoon, the free speech woes are at their door again, just gets that indignation going and riles people up. So, but anyhow, I think we'll continue to debate that. It's fantastic to get things moving that quickly. But I think a bit of indignation's coming again today with the new story that you've been working on over the weekend, Ben.
Yes, it is. It is. Brace yourselves. This is the story that has been reported by Robert Mendick in The Telegraph. There's been follow-up coverage in The Mail, by Sky News as well, of Michelle Shipworth, an academic at UCL. We've been speaking to Michelle since October of last year because she runs, or I should say ran, a module at UCL called Data at Detectives, in which she asked students to look at a piece of data on a slide on the extent and scale of modern slavery globally. And she asked students the question, why are there so many slaves in China? She's been asking this question, or variation of it, for 10 years as part of this module. Crucially, the point of the module is not to explore slavery or modern slavery in China. In fact, the point of this slide in this seminar is to get students to look at this data set, which is not particularly reliable, to critically examine it, engage with it, and debunk some of the claims that it makes. So that's the theme, that's the purpose of the module. Another data set could have been picked. She could have picked another case study. She happened to pick this one because this particular survey, the Global Slavery Index 2014, was quite widely debunked and rubbished for various methodological reasons. So in October, she, for the 10th time, asked students on this course this question. And towards the end of the seminar, a single Chinese student stood up. He was quite angry, and he asked why she had posed such a provocative question to the class. Provocative question. Now, you would say actually the whole point in a seminar leader is to provoke students to get them to engage with the topic, particularly when you're trying to get them to engage with a claim and to debunk it. She didn't think anything more of it. And what happened then really is extraordinary, because she found that a complaint had been made against her in the days after this class had taken place. And then, this really is extraordinary, that her communication access to her students via Moodle, this is the sort of platform that UCL uses for these sorts of communications between lecturers and students, that her access to that had been suspended. And she was told that this is, and I'll quote, this is a currently geopolitically controversial and, quote again, a sensitive subject. And she was placed in a position where her department were telling her that she was essentially not trusted to communicate with her students, and that her communications were going to have to be vetted, all because she'd asked this question. Now, her communication rights were restored, and that could have been the end of the story. And if you've been following the coverage over the weekend, you will know, of course, that it is not. That, again, incredibly, I keep finding there's no other word to describe this, but incredible. It is unbelievable what happened next. This happened. She then spoke about what had happened internally, and again, it all seemed to be resolved. And then she sent an email to colleagues in her department at UCL saying that academic freedom needed to be defended, and that this represented, this episode, still a relatively trivial incident, had been nonetheless an infringement of her academic freedom. Mm. Okay, fair enough. Again, that could have been the end of the matter. Incredibly, and I use the word once more, academics in her department then made a complaint against her, about her, anonymously, for sending an email defending academic freedom. And they did so, Tom, via the report and support portal, which has become notorious. This is something that exists across the university sector now, and it allows students or staff to make anonymous complaints. And the focus of the... Yeah, go on, Tom, go on.
I was just going to ask that, probably exactly what you were going to come on to. What would colleagues, academic colleagues, be putting into that portal in response to the email that Michelle sent? Because saying that I think academic freedom is really important, you'd have thought she'd get an applause from her colleagues for that. Even now, I know that our universities are in a bit of a pickle, but even now, I would have thought that academics would say, yes, academic freedom is important. So what exactly were they going to the portal and submitting in their complaint?
The allegation was that she had exhibited anti-Chinese bias. Now, report and support, you can go and look at this on the UCL website for yourself. The first sentence on this webpage says, we believe that bullying, harassment, and sexual misconduct are never okay. So this is a system that is designed for students, academic staff, to make reports of bullying, harassment, and sexual misconduct. All pretty serious stuff. And instead, it's been used to make this entirely spurious complaint that Michelle has some kind of anti-Chinese bias, and that is what motivated her to put this single question in this seminar. Michelle's not an expert on China. She's not focused on China. She doesn't teach about China. All she did was happen to use a data set that dealt with the question of slavery in China. She could have picked a different data set. She happened to pick this one for the reasons I've explained. And on the basis of that, this complaint was made. She had also exposed cheating by a small number of Chinese students. And all of these things were then bundled together to demonstrate this anti-Chinese bias.
And Ben, you're talking about more than one report in this report portal. So it wasn't just one academic, it was multiple
Correct.
Of her colleagues who'd gone in and made this concerned or made this
Correct.
Complaint.
Yes, that's right. And then what happened, this was last year, at the end of last year, and then she was told that additional students had made a complaint this year. Now, the result of all of this has been that she has been told that she cannot teach her module. She has also been told that, she's been asked by her head of department that she not tweet solely about China, or that she not use single countries as case studies, which all of these restrictions, and there was another as well, that she not sort of single out particular students in seminars to answer questions. All of these restrictions are ludicrous, because if you're trying to teach a group of students and you're told that you can't ask individual students questions and that you can't use any individual country as a case study, how on earth are you supposed to deliver this course? Those are ludicrous restrictions. The point, if I could just dwell on the point about her social media. Again, this is a direct quote. She was told that her tweets about China were problematic. Mm. And in fact, she looked back through her Twitter account, and the only post she could find that was at all relevant was one in which she had defended academic freedom again. So this is not somebody who's spending every waking moment kind of obsessively tweeting about China and its human rights records, which, by the way, would be a completely legitimate use of your time. So even if she were doing that, fine, fair enough. There's a lot to say about that. But that isn't what she was doing. She just happened to use this single case study. And this was going on. There'd been a long back and forth, as you'd imagine, between Michelle and her head of department. And her head of department, one of the remarkable details that I think has really resonated with people is that Michelle said to him in an email, again, negotiating these issues, talking about the importance of freedom for academics, freedom of speech, academic freedom, and so on. She invoked John Stuart Mill.
Yeah.
And he replied, I have no idea who J.S. Mill is. How on earth do you get to be the head of a department at UCL and not know who J.S. Mill is? And if somehow that has happened to you, why on earth do you put that in writing and not Google him first? I mean...
What was his specialist subject? Because as a mathematician, I would probably, if I'd ever reached a head of department, I probably wouldn't know who J.S. Mill is or was either.
He's an economist.
Right.
So... Right. There's no defense here, I'm afraid. Anyway,
I'm looking for it.
You're playing devil's advocate. There was a letter in the Telegraph on this subject this morning. We're speaking on Monday the 11th. This is something that's resonated. And the comments on Twitter and under the Telegraph reporting, this is one of the details that people were saying, you know, my God, how is this possible? I saw somebody described it as the perfect epitaph for... our profession, an academic said on Twitter.
Well, I mean, you're right. You're right about if you haven't heard of something, and I do it, you do it, you go and you find out about it. You don't, especially if you have academic credentials, if this is in your wheelhouse, to use that phrase, if it's in your wheelhouse, then you go and find out about it and save yourself the embarrassment of, as you say, putting it in writing, I have no idea who J.S. Mill is. That's just kind of, step 101, isn't it, of how to engage in this sort of incredible. This sort of debate or this sort of discussion.
Yeah, just incredible. The line I think that's most devastating from the department to Michelle was that after there'd been all of this back and forth, it's been going on for 4 or 5 months, in an email in which she was told that she... I'll quote, may wish to consider not posting on social media about only one country unspecified, but I think we can guess which one, and which she was told that she should be, quote, mindful of students' ability to be very critical on some topics, for example, if this would impact their future careers. She was instructed to do all of these things, all of these restrictions imposed on her, and this was done on the basis that, direct quote, in order to be commercially viable, our MSc courses need to retain a good reputation amongst future Chinese applicants. So that's it. I just don't see any defense of that that's possible whatsoever. The department has explicitly and in writing said, you can't talk about modern slavery in China because our courses need to be commercially viable and we can't risk upsetting
yeah.
Chinese students. Now, the thing that's worth saying, and I'll stop talking at this point, Tom, so you can butt in. So it's been an extended monologue for me. but it's worth saying that even this is somewhat ludicrous because on Chinese social media, there's in fact, before all of this happened, I don't know what it's like today, there was only one reference to Michelle, and it was a positive one. And she's worked with Chinese teaching assistants, Chinese PhD students, literally hundreds of Chinese students who've gone through this course without issue. And so what we're seeing is a relatively small number of hardline activists, basically, putting these complaints in and using the language of, I'm distressed, this is too distressing, this shouldn't happen. And then the university, of course, is already primed for those kinds of arguments because everything has been so snowflakey for such a long time. And it has, in its words, to remain commercially viable, and it's terrified about losing the lifeline of student funding from overseas students, particularly Chinese students, which heavily subsidizes the costs for UK students. Right, that's me done. That's the story. That's the essence of it.
I mean, several things within that that jump out at me. The first is that in the original incident, it was a lecture, a course, a moment about data. And clearly the person who went up at the end had totally misunderstood the point of the lecture. It was, as you say, to make the reverse point. The data was dodgy, and actually what looked like a problem in China was a bit more nuanced, and the data needed to be thought through a little bit more carefully. So it might have been a provocative question, but the whole point was in many ways the opposite. The second thing, and I think this is the thing that jumps out throughout, is what I would call this patronizing fragility when it comes to, and it could be other religions, it can be other races, it can be other countries, it can be other cultures. But in essence, we now have in the West, and this is a perfect example of it, we take an approach of they're fragile. We can't critique them. They'll get hurt. And it's, first of all, I think, extremely patronizing, which is why your point about the social media that's actually also happened, and I don't know whether was it in China, people had posted positive responses to her course and what she was doing.
Right. So what had happened was she was at an early stage of this process trying to establish, you know, what harm, if any, had been done to UCL's reputation among potential Chinese students. And so she asked somebody to look on Chinese social media. Right. There was only one reference to Michelle Shipworth at UCL, and it was a positive one.
And so it's very, very patronizing, isn't it? To suppose that by asking a provocative question, by being specific in your question, somehow you are, you know, the culture is so fragile, or the people are so fragile, the country is so fragile, that the question is out of bounds. And it's almost the opposite of being colonial. It's saying, we dare not stray onto that territory at all in case someone gets upset. And of course, it gets weaponized by a minority of people who see it, who see our own fear of giving offense and take offense, because then they know they'll get treated, as we know, as the victim. So patronizing fragility is the second. So the first thing is, I think, the whole misunderstanding the point in the lecture in the first place. The second thing is the patronizing fragility. And the third thing that jumps out is this commercial interest versus academic freedom. You know, I mean, let's be honest. We all know that forever, universities, institutions are driven by commercial interests. You know, they have to be. Colleges were founded by kings and queens of England in Cambridge and Oxford because they had the resources, the money, and they also provided an environment within which that academic endeavor could then take place. So money is, and we're all rung up all the time as alumni by our institutions to make sure that the money carries on rolling in, even with a Cambridge, even with an Oxford or a Harvard or whatever. So they've always been there. And there does have to be a realism. However, it's quite clear that that balance between commercial interests and academic freedom has just swung. So, do balances swing? I've probably got that wrong. But they have just swung so far now in the direction of commercial interests at the cost of academic freedom that you do get these sort of velvet gloved threats from those in authority. You know, commercial interests, come on. We need to put those first. So that's the third thing that really jumps out at me there, Ben, is just this, that's enough. It's enough to say that. And I think it was Sir Ian Duncan Smith has actually written a piece over the weekend making a very similar point. And Sir Ian, of course, is one of a string of politicians who's actually been sanctioned by Beijing over his criticism of China. And he told The Mail, this was, he said, a lot of universities have basically admitted to me, to Ian Duncan Smith, that they are completely in hock with Chinese students, that they wouldn't be able to exist if they didn't have their fees. So we do have that problem between commercial interests and between an academic freedom. And it's reached an intolerable level now, as this example shows. But it's come at such a cost, such a personal cost for Michelle, of course.
Yeah. I think what we can see is this very adept hijacking of Western cultural pathologies by this minority of hardcore Chinese activists within UCL and other universities, indeed, too, where they are able to use the language of being distressed or xenophobia, anti-Chinese bias, etc., etc. And that's a very skillful way of jumping on bandwagons that are fashionable right now, particularly in universities, and pursuing your own pretty nefarious objectives in that costume, using that kind of language. It's worth saying as well, one of the points I'd make just about Michelle is that she has no history of being disciplined or investigated at work. Her record's entirely clean. And one of the things about this process that is so unusual is that all of these restrictions that were placed on her were done so, if you like, informally. There was no process. There was no point at which she was brought into formal meetings and said, you are being formally investigated for anti-Chinese bias. Here's the date of the meeting. Here's where you'll have the opportunity to defend yourself. You have the right to have a trade union rep come with you, et cetera, et cetera. None of that happened. It was all done via email or these kind of informal meetings. And she was given these sort of veiled instructions. So, you know, it might be worth you not doing this, or would you consider not doing that or not talking about these things? And then she was given formal instructions as well, like and restrictions such as having the module that, by the way, she designed being taken off her and assigned to one of her colleagues. So all of this happened informally. And you can see why, because the department would have become, as it now has, an absolute laughingstock if it had tried to formally investigate her for anti-Chinese bias when there's absolutely no evidence of that. And there can't be evidence because she's not biased against Chinese people.
I think if you look at the different groups in this saga, you've got the students themselves, and they are least culpable in all of this. They're students. And yes, they know how to use a woke system to pursue their interests. It's the authorities, always the authorities, and also, of course, the academic colleagues who put the complaint in the first place, you know, utterly willfully blind to academic freedom. I don't know. Willful blindness seems to be playing a part in all of this. But the authorities immediately, and I suppose I was about to say kowtow, but I don't know. They might put a secret complaint into me because of that. But they do. They kowtow immediately when they see trouble on the horizon and take what they think would be a simple way out. It's the sneaky approach to free speech and free expression as well, isn't it? It's that, well, do you really need to say that? Couldn't you put that in another way? and immediately narrowing the breadth of the discussion, or even the things that make a discussion interesting. The authorities sort of immediately trying to find a sneaky, snaky way out of this pickle, as you say, knowing that if they really do bang a drum and cause a fuss and open an investigation, they'll be laughed out of court. It's that sneaky, another version of this chilling effect of saying, yeah, oh, come on, you know, we're all on the same page here. We're all on the same side. Can't you just make a few tweaks here and a few tweaks there? And the answer really is, it takes a bold person to say, no, actually, this is my line. And clearly, Michelle's a bold person, clear-thinking yep. person who said, no, I'm not taking this, making these changes. I'm not going to stop doing what I've done for 10 years for these rather strange, dubious reasons. So again, on all sides, it's that. It's not quite Shakespearean, but it's a very predictable set of actors on stage who all have their parts and who all play their parts. I wonder if we could almost have written out how it was going to play out over the months to come, given well, particularly yeah. you, Ben, given your knowledge of the way authorities behave.
There's an element of that. And it's partly... And this is the argument that's been coming from the higher education sector for years. It's been coming from the left for years, I think, legitimately, about the commercialization of higher education and the effect that then has on academic freedom and freedom of speech. Because all of the financial incentives that the university has are basically towards shutting Michelle up and to getting this question taken out of this seminar and just quietening the whole thing down. And of course, they've handled it so cack-handedly. They've behaved so wrongly that the whole thing's blown up and is a national news story. So it's a complete, but by their own standard, it's a complete disaster. The thing I just say in terms of having the courage to speak out about these things, you know, it requires bravery. It also requires being in the right position in your career, and you know, it depends on your responsibilities and how able you are to take risks. And if you're, you know, the sole breadwinner, or you know, you've got mortgage bills and children and family and so on, you know, it's quite difficult to be courageous. And so it does require something quite special, actually, to do what Michelle has done and have the courage of your convictions and say, look, you know, I could have just taken this on the chin and, you know, not taught the module and fine, just got on with it. But instead she said, no, this is an outrageous attack on academic freedom and I'm going to speak out about it. And because of the broader issues, I feel that I've got to do so publicly. So the other point to make as well is that the FSU has written to the provost and we are hopeful that these restrictions will be lifted. So that's what we're campaigning for with Michelle.
So that was my next question. You know, where are we and what happens yeah. next? So we've written yeah. a letter. So yeah. what happens after that, Ben?
Well, we're hopeful then that the provost will intervene to make sure that these restrictions are lifted. I mean, all of these things have been done informally. As I said, there's been no formal process.
I see.
It's
possible to kind of row back and go back to where it was. Because it's been informal. There hasn't been a formal process.
UCL did give a quote to the press, and they said, while it would not be appropriate to comment on individual questions, the issues raised are clearly concerning and we're working to establish what has happened. So we are hopeful that there will be a decisive intervention that restores Michelle's academic freedom and her right to teach her module. Could I just make one other point? And this is a broader point, really. Obviously, particularly since summer of 2020, universities have been doing everything they can to decolonize. They've obsessively focused on introducing, in a very crass and I think often entirely inappropriate way, introducing diversity into the teaching of the humanities and, in fact, into the sciences as well. Part of that has been a focus on the evils of empire, the evils of the Atlantic slave trade, and so on. And yet, when Michelle, in a very mild way, wanted to just touch upon the question of modern slavery. This department at UCL has run as far away from it as it possibly can, which suggests to me that actually their interest in slavery is somewhat insincere, and it's much more about appearing to be fashionable and keeping up with progressive trends from American universities and American institutions, and about appeasing a hardcore of student activists. They're not really interested in slavery or the evils of slavery.
Well, they're not interested, put it even further, they're not interested in quality academic endeavor. No. When it's not the STEM subjects, not interested in quality academic endeavor, because there are very reasonable topics to be discussed. Modern slavery, other forms of slavery than the trendy forms that go into critical theory. It's a more, in many ways, a more profound damning of the whole academic endeavor, university institutions, that they shut down academic debate, shut down research. And there was that very famous, and I can't remember who it was, you may remember better than me, Ben, but when it comes to critical theory, these mad theories that have come up about, you know, white privilege, systemic racism everywhere, anti-colonialism and whatnot, the rewriting of history. I think someone, a couple of academics, they made up some papers with the trendy words in them based on data. And totally imaginary studies. And they submitted 10, 15, 20 of these papers, and a good proportion of them got through and were published in esteemed publications. And I apologize to listeners, I don't have the details to hand, but I think it was a really good exercise in showing just how much a load of this, you know, this is a load of tosh, a lot of this stuff, a lot of this critical theory. And I come back to this idea, it was just made up. I was thinking about this over the weekend. You know, it was like someone in a university in the 1960s or the 1970s had a brain fart and just decided, hey guys, we're going to do this now. And so everyone went, oh, that sounds fun. Yeah, let's do that. Because Marxism didn't work the first time round. Why don't we rebrand it, create a new set of oppressors, a new set of people who are oppressed, a new victim pyramid, and I'm sure that will work, a treat. And that's really what happened. That's where all these critical theories came from. It was nothing more than that.
There will be listeners who are familiar with the Circle Affair, who I think will be keen for me to read out the title of the article that he submitted, Tom, which
yes,
was
please.
Transgressing the Boundaries Towards a Transformative Human...
You've lost it, man. You see, maybe that's why I didn't have it to hand.
Too funny. Let me try this again. Transgressing the Boundaries Towards a Transformative Hermeneutics of Quantum Gravity, which proposed that that gravity was a social construct. So that's what it was.
Someone needs to tell Sir Isaac.
There we are. Yeah. Anyway, gosh, right, we better move on because we're running rapidly out of time. There's one other thing we want to talk about in a bit of detail, which is a report.
This is a report published today, Monday, the 11th of March. It was produced by Alexander Meleagru Hitchens, who is a researcher in terrorism radicalization. And it's a report that exposes the links between activists at the forefront of the recent protests we've seen in the UK and an extremist Islamist political party in Pakistan, whose members have regularly called for blasphemers to be beheaded. And the name of that party in Pakistan, I'm going to call it the TLP, but it's Tehreek-e-Labak. And from now on, it's TLP. It's a political party that was temporarily banned in Pakistan because of violent rallies and because of its support for mob executions of just perceived blasphemers. And now there is TLP UK, a UK wing of this party. And it really, I think what's interesting about this, Ben, and you'll be able to speak about this more authoritatively than me, is that it refers to two events that we have been not involved in, but obviously, well, we have been involved in, we've helped people And we've certainly written letters in the first case. So the first one being the Batley Grammar School teacher. The second as well being a flashpoint with in relation to the film Lady of Heaven, where we wrote letters to Cineworld and to the government on that, and also we wrote to West Yorkshire Police in relation to four pupils at a school in Wakefield who were suspended over that scuffing of a Quran. So we've been involved in a number of the incidents that are referred to in the report as evidence of the growing problem of this new form of blasphemy in the United Kingdom, and that we haven't been able to have the discussion we need to have in the past. Even now, I think we talked about this before, we seem not to be able to have this discussion openly about a new blasphemy law. And meanwhile, what this report uncovered is what's really going on underneath, which is very, very worrying. These are organizations that are banned in Pakistan, setting themselves up in the UK. So we're going down a very, very worrying path. And this report should be a wake-up call. But Ben, how many wake-up calls do we need? Or are we just hitting the snooze button again on this one?
Quite. Yeah, we're waiting at the moment. We're speaking before the report's come out, but there's been coverage of it in the Times, I think the Mail as well. So it's welcome that the report has been done. And obviously this phenomenon of the report uses the language of anti-blasphemy extremism is how it describes it. Obviously that's a phenomenon that's growing and growing and growing. As you just said, Tom, there've been so many examples just in recent years. I completed my PhD quite recently on ex-Muslims in the UK. They also are victims of this anti-blasphemy extremism, to use that language. This is something we've spoken about a lot, particularly since October. And while I welcome the report, I mean, all of these things, we're very late in the day. We're very late in the day, because I was looking at a Comres poll that the BBC had commissioned nearly a decade ago. This was back in 2015. And that found that 25% of British Muslims aged 18 to 34 thought that acts of violence against blasphemers could sometimes be justified. I do not think, given the scenes we see every Saturday in London, that particular problem has gone away or moderated itself. I don't see any basis for thinking that view has become rarer in the intervening 10 years. And this is something that is, I think, going to take generations to resolve, if it can be resolved. There's no guarantee it can be resolved. But what the Free Speech Union has done, as you've said, Tom, we have been trying to move the dial however we can, firstly by talking about these things very directly, but secondly, by intervening where, for instance, charities have been involved in doxing the Batley Grammar School teacher, or where we can point to the prevent duty in cases where officials or teachers or whoever have not been challenging this type of extremism as they should be. What's frustrating, though, among many frustrations, is that we are still at the point with this conversation, 34 years on from the Satanic Verses, of saying, oh, maybe it would be a good idea if the state stopped funding these groups. You think? We're still at the point of saying, maybe these groups shouldn't be registered charities. You think? it's just extreme. Maybe we should stop funding our enemies and people who hate us. Right.
Okay. It's Muslims who are laboring under this as well. You go back to your PhD on Muslims who've left the faith. There are many Muslims in the LGBT community who are constantly, I mean, they are under threat. But also, of course, there's the Ahmadi Muslim sect, which just gets absolutely piled on, because they're a sect that's deemed blasphemous and their beliefs are deemed insulting to Muhammad and to the Quran. Yeah. And of course, the closer, it's always the way with religion, isn't it? Whenever there's heresy, if it comes from within the camp, then it is the worst kind of heresy. Because if you're outside the camp, if you're non-Muslim, we expect it. We expect it. And the worrying thing about this report is that even we are going to have to stop insulting Islam or the Prophet, but not being allowed to insult the Prophet. But if you are from within the camp, from within the camp, then you get piled on even more. And that's what's happening with the Ahmadi Muslim sect and with people who leave and all sorts of other groups like that.
All of these groups are canaries in the coal mine for the rest of us, by the way. So whether that is believing Muslims who are liberal and moderate, or gay Muslims, or ex-Muslims, or Jews being able to walk through central London on a Saturday, or ex-Muslims, all of these groups can tell us what the state of free speech actually is in modern Britain. And I think the clearest, simplest test of all will be if the Batley Grammar School teacher and his family can ever come out of hiding. I suspect they will not be able to. I don't see how they will be able to. Maybe that's pessimistic, and I hope I'm wrong about it.
Well, I went back over the weekend to Ayaan Hirsi Ali. We've talked about her many times, but there are two things she said when I was listening to a podcast she's done recently. First of all, she went back to her classification of Muslims in the West into Mecca Muslims who maybe go back to when Muhammad's sayings in the Quran were more peaceful. Medina Muslims, which are when Muhammad moved to Medina, suddenly the sayings in the Quran become rather less peaceful, through to Reformed Muslims, who are absolutely kind of a bit like Church of England Christians, kind of completely integrated into society, Western society, and can live with it and tolerate it and don't see a conflict between their religion and democracy and the liberal values of democracy. So the first thing she does, she classifies them like that. She doesn't really say, look, they're radicalized and extremists. She doesn't think of it in the terms in which we do. She says there are actually core beliefs that play out differently according to which part of the Quran, which part of Muhammad's life you go back to. And the second thing she said, which was a complete surprise to me, she said that, we've looked at the streets of London. We've talked about the streets of London since the 7th of October. And we said, my goodness me, Hizb ut-Tahrir on the streets of London praying publicly, Allah Akbar, coming out of that in a very worrisome world, and jihad. She said, the acts of celebration that happened on the streets of London after October the 7th, they happened back after 9/11 in Europe, but no one ever reported on it, and they were very small. And the message was, don't worry, it's small, nothing to worry about. And then after 7/7 in London in 2005, it happened again, but again, oh, don't worry, it's just a small number. Well, the streets of London, and you've said this before, sometimes freedoms reveal things. Sometimes freedom of speech is really important. Freedom of expression is really important for revealing things. I don't think we can now say we don't have a problem. I think it's eminently clear with both the scale of what's happened since the invasion of Israel, plus these incidents that we've been involved in. I think that there's an absolute necessity to wake up. And for some kind of leadership to take the reins. And this shutting down of debate by everything's called Islamophobic for criticizing religion. Yeah. I go back finally, my final point, Ben, before you jump in, because I know this is also your specialized subject because of your PhD. Mm. But I go back to what you said last week about the definition of Islamophobia and the fact that there's a paper now on the Free Speech Union website with both the name of Tindy Epp from the Christian Concern, I think, or the Christian Legal Center. And so obviously a Christian. And then you've got Professor Richard Dawkins, who is a leading new atheist, putting their names to a paper coming from completely different perspectives, because they're saying we have a problem that we need to think through here, because or we are at risk of losing something very precious and very fundamental to who we are as a society. That's the end of my rant, Ben.
There is one parallel I would draw between the two stories we've spoken about, with what happened at UCL and this very small number of Chinese students who've been able to derail this module, get Michelle cancelled from her course, influence the teaching that their other fellow Chinese students are able to get, and this phenomenon of anti-blasphemy extremism, in which you can see it only takes a very small number of highly motivated people to affect political change. That can be for the good. In both of these cases, it is for the ill, if you believe in the Western tradition, freedom of speech, freedom of expression and conscience and so on. And what our society is incredibly susceptible to now is the action of small numbers of people who can plausibly claim or appear to be plausible that they speak for a vast section of opinion. So society needs to get much better at resisting that. We also, though, need to, I think, confront in a fairly direct way the fact that the idea that blasphemy should be a criminal matter, the idea that blasphemy could sometimes be responded to with violent action, these are not fringe beliefs among British Muslims, according to all the evidence we have. Now, I will accept that the polling of minority groups is a relatively inexact science. There are methodological problems with that. So I don't want to be too definitive in what I'm saying. But it is clear, broadly speaking, that these are not fringe views. And that if we have a substantial block of people who are saying that insulting my religion should be a criminal matter, that's a problem for freedom of speech. It doesn't have to get violent. That's already a massive problem for freedom of speech.
I think we're there. I think that I go back to the pictures from back grammar school. Yeah. I think the pictures from Wakefield after the scuffing of the Quran, and it's clear. And it's also absolutely chilling to see the British state in the form of the police officers sitting alongside and nodding along to this and saying, yes, we agree, this shouldn't have happened. It's a very dire state of affairs. But this report is hopefully an important marker now to raise the alarm on this. But I'm not going to hold my breath, Ben. I feel our listeners are going to be feeling very concerned and depressed, and we apologize for that. But we do scour the free speech news each week to look for positive items. And at the moment, I think there is positive spin on particularly the Michelle Shipworth one, that there are courageous people out there. Every single one of our members in our casework are courageous. The people who come to us, they are courageous. So we just need to work, carry on grinding away at this problem, case by case, and recognizing the wins when they come our way. And not have that council of despair, I think, which is always a risk, I think, with all of this.
And we win most of the time. 74% of the time that the FSU is involved in a case, we win. So we should also probably say, Tom, welcome to new members who've joined us. There's been a lot of press coverage of the FSU in the last 2 months, particularly since the start of the year. So thank you for joining. If you're new to us and if you're a new listener, thank you very much for listening. Well, for a final bit of good news, we can return to the fact, as we said right at the top of the episode, that we have raised 10 grand for Lindsay. In a matter of days. And thank you again to everyone who donated, whether it was £5 or 500. It all makes a difference.
That's all from me, Ben. I don't know if anything else from you.
No, I think that's everything. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.